Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
It's back on the podcast, and in this second part, we're going to take a look at Greek history from 330 BC until 2023. He is the author of the book, The Greeks, A Global History, which is also the title of this episode. And the last one, we're going to take a look at his Greek history from 1500 BC until 330 BC. And let's just start right away, because we don't need the introduction as we did last time, because you don't have to watch this episode, last week's episode, to understand this one. I highly recommend you should do so, but, you know, we're not going to get into the introduction as we did last time, but let's start from the age of Constantine, as we talked about ending last week's episode, and then move to Constantinople. And we talked, like I said, I want to begin with his son, actually, because he was, unlike Constantine, he was not a Christian. He was very much a pagan still, wasn't he?
Ah, this is the Emperor Julian, who was a cousin, I think the relationship was. He was the younger generation.
Right, anyway. Yeah.
He was a cousin of Constantine's son. He was one of the same family. And the memorable thing about Constantine is he was the first Roman emperor who decided to support Christianity, and he became the first Christian emperor of the first Christian ruler of the Roman Empire. And after him, right through for more than 1,000 years, the empire that we now call Byzantine was a Christian empire. But there was one brief exception from the years 361 to 363, when the Emperor Julian, who was a relative of Constantine, attempted to reverse all that, to put the clock back, to bring back the worship of the old gods, to have sacrifices in front of temples in the way that they used to do for hundreds of years. And because of that, he's always ever after been remembered as the apostate, meaning the denier of Christianity. He failed. But it was a fascinating episode in Greek and in also in Roman, European indeed, history.
What made him, was he an unpopular ruler, or was he famous? Because there was still quite a lot of pagans in the Roman world, but was he an unpopular ruler, or how come he failed to try to bring back paganism? Yeah.
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, as I said at the end of our talk last time, Constantine was the first Christian emperor, but it took really 200 years before the whole of the Roman Empire became fully Christian until the time of Justinian. So there was a lot to play for. There was a lot of, uncertainty. People were getting used to new ideas. There was some competition between Christians and non-Christians. And generally, I mean, Constantine himself and his successors, they were quite tactful in introducing Christianity. They didn't, by and large, use force. They didn't try to intimidate people into becoming Christian. They were subtler, but basically they wanted to encourage people to become Christian. Mm. That meant that, you know, 30 years after the time of Constantine, there was still a lot of pagan things going on. Julian, as a young man, went to study philosophy in Athens. So he learned, he learned ancient Greek. He learned to read the ancient Greek philosophers. He read all the Greek literature, and he loved all of that. And I think really his idea was almost to elevate the old Greek ideas of philosophy and literature and mythology into something equal to, or as he saw it, superior to Christianity. So he actually wanted to, you know, to organize ancient Greek religion in a way that it never had been before. It was a strange, you know, it's always called putting the clock back, restoring the old ways. But in many ways, Julian was actually trying to reinvent the ancient Greek religion along the lines of the Jewish religion or Christianity. Mm. So it was a curious kind of hybrid. If he hadn't died in battle 18 months after he came to power, who knows, he might have been successful. Mm. But he was killed in battle, and nobody really had any great stomach after that to carry on his project, so it mm. fell by the wayside.
Of course, we don't have time to go through the entire... We are going to go through the entire Byzantine history as well, but we don't have time to go through the most... Mm. All of it, unfortunately, and especially as I would like to. But some next emperor that I want to talk about, of course, is, I feel like he's definitely worth a mention here, is Theodosian, who, of course, is known for the famous Theodosian walls. So let's talk about Theodosian for a while and how he thought about building these significant and beautiful walls of Constantinople.
Yeah, well, this is Theodosius II, who came to the throne, I think, in 408, and he was very young at the time. The walls had been begun just before, I think, before he came to the throne. They were finished, at least they were inaugurated, in 413. And so it was really the prefect of the city, a man called Anthemios, who probably should deserve the credit for designing and building these massive walls. But this was a stupendous fortification. It's three layers thick. It's a series of walls and ditches and guardhouses. A large extent of that is still extant. You can see it. It's a significant monument in the middle of today's Istanbul.
A dream of mine personally is to go to Istanbul and just go through the walls and take a look at this significant, marvelous
There's one short stretch that has actually been reconstructed or restored in modern times. Quite a lot of the rest is in a very ruinous condition. But they enclose a wide urban area. Constantinople was barely 100 years old, but it was already a big city and growing. But this was in the early 5th century. It's the time of, in inverted commas, the barbarian incursions. There were barbarians on the move. People from outside the empire were crossing over the Danube. Some of them were Christian, most of them were not. They were regarded as dangerous. They were hostile. They were armed. Nothing like the migrants or asylum seekers of today who come genuinely seeking help in Europe. These were people. Whole family groups with their warriors, their menfolk, their women, their dependents, their carts and their agricultural implements. They wanted to move, or they were under pressure to move to find somewhere to live in a new place. And they crossed over into the empire. They were a real danger to the institutions of the empire. And the Theodosian walls were part of the very effective defences that were too much for the barbarians, made it too much for the barbarians conquer Constantinople. So some of those barbarians, as a result, headed west, and they set fire to Rome instead. And famously, the famous invasions of the Huns in 451.
And this is where, of course, the end of the Roman Empire.
It's the end of the Roman Empire in the west, but the Roman Empire continues uninterrupted in Constantinople in the east for another 1,000 years.
So let's talk about the Byzantine Empire, and you do hesitate in using that name in the book for a little while and further into the book when you talk about them. But we spoke about the Theodosian, but there's someone I want to talk about that is rather significant, and that is the peasant Justin. How does he manage to become the emperor and form a kind of dynasty in Byzantine world?
Well, the great figure here is Justinian, who came to the throne in 529, and he codified a thousand years of old Roman law, so that whenever today in the world we talk of Roman law as being the basis for modern legal systems, this is based on the compilation made by Justinian scholars on his orders in Constantinople.
But wasn't it his father who was a peasant to enter the throne, if I remember correctly?
Well, yes, indeed. And sorry, he came to the throne in 527, not 529.
Yeah.
529 is when he issued his first law codes. His uncle, actually, I think it was his uncle Justin,
right,
was the simple Balkan. Well, they said he was a peasant. He wasn't very highly educated, but he was a military man. Mm. And very often Roman emperors rose from the ranks, through the ranks of the military. So yes, Justin, the uncle of Justinian, was 70 years old when he came to the throne.
How did he justify, did he assert the throne? How did he justify his claim to the throne?
They had they didn't really have an organized system. Sometimes it was the son of the reigning emperor, but more often than not, it wasn't. And there was an old Roman custom that actually, rather than, you know, emperors came and went, they could be deposed, or when an emperor died, it would very often be the army or the commanders of the army who would get together in a huddle, and they would, they would promote their own candidate, and the strongest man would win. In those days, it actually devolved not just to the army, but to the ordinary people of Constantinople. And what happened was everybody got together in what they called the Hippodrome. It was a kind of race course, a chariot used for chariot racing in the middle of the city. And all the citizenry would gather there, and they would cheer. They were divided according to the chariot teams that they supported. And if you were, a candidate would be supported by the Blues, which supported one bunch of chariot racers, or another by the Greens, who supported another. And quite often they would come to blows in the Hippodrome. And it was when you got enough people in the Hippodrome chanting the name of one particular candidate, that person then emerged on the balcony, and everybody would say, you are the emperor, we bow down before you. And that was how Justin became emperor. He then adopted his nephew Justinian as his son, and Justinian, therefore, in his mid-40s, came to the throne, with that uncontroversially. But Justinian was one of the longest reigning emperors. He reigned until 565, I think it was. So it's more than 35 years. And also one of the most effective. The three main things he did. One, I mentioned, was codifying the laws.
Yeah.
The other was he built the great cathedral church of the Holy Wisdom, Hagia Sophia in Greek. And thirdly, he sent his armies west into the Mediterranean with a fleet of transport ships into the western Mediterranean. He reconquered a significant part of the Western Roman Empire in the west, around the Mediterranean, that had been lost to the barbarians. So this period is often referred to as the Byzantine reconquest under Justinian.
Right. And so you mentioned Hagia Sophia, and let's talk about the building, because it didn't take that long, if I remember correctly, to build Hagia Sophia.
An extraordinary feat to build what was for a thousand years the largest building, certainly the largest religious building anywhere in the world, and it was built in just 5 years.
Yeah, that's significant.
It is. I mean, the Parthenon in Athens took 15 years, and even that is considered a pretty remarkable feat. But Hagia Sophia, it's a huge church. It's enormously high, something like 60 meters to the top of the dome, and it uses this highly sophisticated, at the time really quite new, Roman system of engineering and architecture, so it's sufficient, capable of raising a wide dome on top of already very tall pillars, and that dome is still standing today.
And we will, of course, mention Islam a little bit later as well, but isn't Hagia Sophia as well one of the recent inspirations behind how mosques would end up being designed as well?
Indeed, indeed, and certainly from the Ottoman conquest of Constantinople and some way before that, the standard design of the certainly the Western the Ottoman mosque was really based on Hagia Sophia. So you've got the dome, the obviously in Islam the minaret is added, but the principle of the square pattern, square or rectangular with dome on top, that's taken over from St. Sophia. And with variations, the same pattern again is followed in some of the great Renaissance churches of the West, the St. Peter's in Rome, St. Paul's in London, the great Cathedral of Florence, for example, all have dome. But St. Sophia is the first the big religious building, and it was indeed the biggest for 1,000 years to have a dome. So that's literally a monumental achievement that survives to this day.
While we are talking about Justinian, before we move on, of course, it's one of his most infamous features. He married an actress at the time. It was not being an actress or actor was not like being Brad Pitt or Angelina Jolie today. It was more or less frowned upon like being a prostitute. So, how did he justify marrying Theodora, who was known as an actress at the time?
Well, exactly. I mean, he was one, he was a very pious emperor. He was one of the first who insisted that every citizen of his empire must be a Christian. So he was a staunch upholder of, and indeed enforcer of, the Christian religion and its values. The stories about Theodora they're very curious. And one of the problems about that is that a lot of what we know about Justinian and his reign was written by a very sophisticated, highly educated man in his court called Procopius. And Procopius wrote a book in which he praised all the wonderful things that Justinian did in his buildings, including St. Sophia. He wrote a very detailed and fairly uncritical account of the various wars that Justinian had waged. But then nobody quite knows why. He wrote this famous libel against Justinian, which is called in English The Secret History. And in this, he tells all the scurrilous stories that must have been circulating in Constantinople about, particularly about Theodora. And it brings in lots of stereotypes. This is how we know that, she was allegedly an actress. She may have been a prostitute. She came from the lowest social class. We just don't know. Was this actually really rather crass sort of male chauvinism by someone who was trying to get at Justinian. She was dead by the time he wrote all this. Or was it all true? There's probably some truth in it. There are wonderful mosaics that you can still see in the Italian city of Ravenna, where on one side of the wall you can see in gilded mosaic, colored mosaics, you can see Justinian, the emperor, and the bishops of his retinue, and facing them on the other side, you see Theodora with her ladies, and there are fountains playing. They're all wearing beautiful clothes and jewelry. It's all very opulent. She's a grand lady. So, was she these scurrilous things that we're told? We just don't know. It's a fascinating conundrum.
And of course, we have to move on as well. We've got a lot of history to cover, and if you're going to cover until 2023 in one episode. And I mentioned, because this is really significant to Byzantine history as well, and that is the birth of Islam. But before, something I've been a little bit curious about is how come the kind of was there no intention in Christianizing the Arabian Peninsula, the Middle East? How did the what why did they send in did they send in missionaries there? But the faith, what was how did come they did not try to Christianize the Middle East?
Well, I mean, in many ways, they did Christianize the Middle East.
I mean,
I mean, all of the, as far as the Roman Empire went, which by this time was at least as far as the, well, it varied, but as far as the River Euphrates and all of Egypt, down to the Red Sea, to the almost to the Arabian, to the Persian Gulf, and very far east, further north as well, into Armenia and Georgia. All these lands were Christian, but nobody paid much attention to Arabia. I mean,
I just forgot the name of the peninsula.
That's right.
So, yeah.
I mean, in Latin they called it Arabia Deserta, because, well, what was it? Indeed, what it is today, it was desert. And in those days, of course, there were no oil wells, or nobody knew what to do with oil if you did find it. So the people who lived there weren't all that many of them. The Romans, as they tended to do with those they called barbarians across the frontier, they would often conscript them as mercenaries.
Right.
They would hire them to do their fighting for them. And very often, across many of these frontiers, Christianity spread spontaneously. There were Christians in Persia. There were Christians further east in Asia. By the 7th century, there were Christians even as far as Western China. So the religion was spreading, partly through Roman official efforts, but also just because people were spontaneously converting to Christianity. And all the other, in inverted commas, barbarian peoples who invaded the Roman Empire, who entered the Roman Empire, and in the West who took it over, all of them converted to Christianity.
Right.
So, they overturned the secular system of the empire, but they created a Christian world, which became medieval Europe, and eventually Europe as we know it today. Why didn't that happen in Arabia? Well, that's history, or if you take a religious view, perhaps divine intervention is involved. But of course, it is part of the Islamic faith, the belief that God spoke to the prophet Muhammad through his angel Gabriel, and the religious teaching that came to the Arabs through Muhammad was it was monotheistic, like the Jewish religion and like Christianity, but it was quite distinctively different. And it was based on this very, fundamentally, this very simple premise that there is simply one God. And, I suspect, who are we to say, but for people who had been bemused for years by arguments about the Christian Trinity, people had to hold, the emperor called church councils, bishops debated the precise relation between God the Father, God the Son, and the Holy Spirit in the Christian religion. So that Christianity is a monotheistic religion, but central to it also is this more complex idea of what is called in Christianity the Trinity. So, is it truly monotheistic? If you take a kind of straightforward view that there can only be the one God, you're just a bit lost in all this argument about God the Son and God the Father. Islam cut through that. And it seems that a lot of Christians in that part of the Roman Empire were really kind of fed up with these debates about the nature of Christ and the Father. They wanted straightforward monotheism. They could just, the Islamic premise was something they warmed to. And lots and lots of people converted very quickly, not to Christianity anymore, but to Islam. And from that time on, the two great monotheistic religions of the world, as they quickly became, Christianity and Islam, basically, fought for influence over people's souls and their, their earthly existence.
Right. And I think this is an important quote as well to mention in the podcast, because we will talk about this, of course, as well later on. But there is this famous story of one general who says to Muhammad that you, sir, are the greatest general of them all, but Muhammad says back to him that no, the one that conquers Constantinople, the apple of the world, I believe, as the Muslims looked at it, that will be the greatest conqueror, the greatest general of them all.
Yes, I mean, I think like many of the sayings attributed to Muhammad that are not actually in the Quran, there's some doubt about whether he actually said it, or who might have said it, or
right.
when. But you're absolutely right that for many centuries it was part of the object of the caliphs, the rulers who followed in the tradition in the footsteps of Muhammad and promoted and fought for the Islamic faith, it was the kind of key achievement was to conquer what they called Rome, based, of course, on the old name of Rome, the Roman Empire. And during the 7th and 8th centuries, there were three serious attempts to conquer Constantinople, and each one of them failed. It was close run. The Arabs, Muslim fleets and land soldiers arrived in the Bosphorus. They laid siege to Constantinople. But at the end of three sieges, they were finally forced to give up, and therefore a kind of boundary was set between Islam and Christianity further east than Constantinople.
And one of the reasons why it was so easy for the Arabs to conquer the Byzantine territory, because they had at the time internal struggles as well, right? They were filled with civil wars and internal strifes and issues that made it easy for the Arabs to conquer the Byzantine lands, if I'm correct.
Well, for once, actually, they weren't so much fighting among themselves. Mm. They've been fighting against the arch enemies for many hundreds of years, the Persians. And the last war between the Romans of Constantinople and the Persian Empire, based on the Tigris, was fought between 602 and 628. And at one stage, the Persians laid siege to Constantinople, but then the tide of war swept the other way. The Emperor Heraclius actually conquered Persia, and the last Persian king of kings was deposed and murdered by his own people. And it looked as though even the great rival Persia was going to become Christian, and the Roman Empire had finally taken over the whole of the Middle East. But what turned out to be the case instead was that both the Persian Empire and the Roman Empire, based on Constantinople, had so exhausted themselves with this titanic struggle that they were, their cities were desolate, their armies were exhausted, many of their people had been killed. They were ready, they were ripe to be taken over by an entirely new force, which was these actually quite, originally quite small armies arriving out of the Arabian desert. And then they recruited many more people from the lands they conquered to become, within just a few decades, a really powerful world empire in their own right, the first caliphate based on Damascus. Mm.
And I remember when you talked about Persia, you write, I believe you write about and there are some scholars that feel neglected in the Byzantine world, and they heard that there was more freedom, and they were allowed to do what they wanted in the Persian Empire. So they traveled to the Persians, if I remember this right. But they were, of course, disappointed to find out that was not the case.
That was not the answer either. No, there is a famous story about Justinian, whom I was talking about a little while ago. I was saying, he was the first who really formally imposed Christianity as the religion of all the empire. And one of the things he did was to close down the schools of philosophy in Athens. That was in 529. So that when and some of the philosophers, they're obviously rather disappointed at being forced to shut up shop. So they actually, they got on a ship, they sailed to Persia, but obviously life wasn't much better for them in Persia. So classical Greek philosophy really came to an end at that point.
And of course, like I said, we have to move on, unfortunately, and then to talk about Justinian and this era for ages. But another Justinian we would have to talk about, and we made an episode about him a while ago actually as well. But that is, of course, the Justinian II, the infamous emperor who lost his nose. So let's talk about Justinian II for a while.
Well, he's a much less well-known emperor. I mean, suppose there is the best known thing about him is his alleged golden nose, his prosthetic nose. Because he was very unusual. He was emperor twice, and he was deposed twice. And the first time.
You have to be a shit emperor if you are deposed twice.
Sorry, how can you?
Yeah, you have to be kind of a shitty emperor if you are deposed twice.
Well, Well, you could say that. On the other hand, you have to be a pretty determined emperor to come back having been deposed.
Right.
The first time they deposed him, they cut off his nose and they slit his tongue. So he's not in the best condition to be an emperor. But a few years after these atrocities had been committed against him, he duly came back with his famous golden nose and proceeded to do equally horrible things to his enemies. So at the end of his second reign, in, I think, 711, they killed him for good. But they certainly didn't. They certainly, you know, he was a man who made a lot of enemies. He was not very effective. He was ruling at a time when Constantinople was under threat from the Arab Muslim armies from the east, and he tried, as all these emperors did, to pull it all together. But as we were saying, he had an awful lot of enemies at home.
Do you think that, we spoke briefly about this in our episode about Justinian II when he made it as well, that he was named Justinian II after Justinian I because he had kind of high, his father had kind of high expectations of him. But do you think that any other emperor would have done fared much better at the time? Like you said, there was a lot of struggles in the empire with the Arab threats and more. Do you think any other emperor would have fared better at the time if there was any other ruling leader of the empire?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, people had high hopes of him, and the whole idea of calling him Justinian II, he was going to be a second Justinian. He was going to reconquer all these lands. But I mean, your question really takes us to one of these big questions of history. You know, is it the sort of great man view of history? Are there individuals who really manage to change history through their own individual personality? Or are there situations where it doesn't matter how great a man you are, if history is moving in that direction, there's actually very little you could do about it? And at that particular juncture, I'm really not sure. I mean, I don't think any of the emperors after Heraclius really is particularly distinguished until Leo III, and he was the, again, another army general who was made emperor just in time to organize the defense of Constantinople in 717, and he succeeded. And then he reigned for another 30 years. So in a very difficult, unpropitious time, Leo III did about as much as it was possible for anyone to do. But I wouldn't, he doesn't really go down in history as one of the great emperors.
No.
But maybe if he'd lived in a different time, he would have been able to do things that would have earned him that kind of reputation.
Because the Heraclian dynasty does end with Justinian II, and it's quite a brutal end to the dynasty, even in Justinian's son as well. And I want to mention this as well, because during his exile, which is 10 years in exile, he does marry, I believe, a bolder woman. And a fun fact as well, he named her Theodora. Nobody knows what she was named before that, but yes, he does name his wife Theodora. But both his son is brutally killed as well at the end of Heraclian. Oh, sorry, end of
it's the end
Justinian
of the
II.
Yes, yes. I mean, again, by and large, dynasties don't tend to last either in the old Roman Empire or in the Byzantine, and neither the Romans nor the Byzantine ever really established a regular system for choosing an emperor. It was a kind of hybrid. There's a kind of, it's partly dynastic, but it's also partly by choice. And there was never really a formally established system, so that succession was endlessly, right throughout for more than 1,000 years, succession was contested. And often emperors, they would, if they particularly short-lived emperors, they left no dynasty at all. And even when they did, I mean, the famous Macedonian dynasty in the middle Byzantine period, it wasn't father to son, and they were still plotting and killing each other within the same extended family.
Right. Which, of course, brings us to something we haven't mentioned in the Byzantine history, which is the infamous iconoclasm era. Because there were two, more or less two iconoclasms. But what was iconoclasm, and how did it have become such a popular feat in the empire?
An endless amount of scholarship and speculation and research has gone into this. It's a fascinating question. The whole idea that, the idea of breaking images, which is what iconoclasm literally means, it's something that reappears from time to time in human history. And so there's a kind of theoretical or principle question of why is it that in certain situations people feel that the images that they've treasured for so long suddenly are no longer appropriate or they turn against them. But the short answer to your question is that after the Islamic conquest, after the loss of all of the Eastern Empire in the Middle East and North Africa, after the near loss of Constantinople itself, when it seemed as though the empire could actually be extinguished, the emperors and the senior clergy during the century after these traumatic and terrifying events really had to reinvent their state from the ground up. And they reorganized the army. They had to devise new systems of taxation because they've got far less revenue. And it was a time to take stock of the religious practices as well. Not the religious beliefs, obviously. This is it's Orthodox Christianity. And what seems to have happened is that it obviously struck people very forcibly that by the end of the or by the time of the siege of Constantinople, the caliphate, the Muslim enemies had banned religious images in the mosque. It didn't happen to begin with, but it happened very soon afterwards. And if you saw your enemy seemingly, winning favor with God, and they don't, their mosque is absolutely bare of ornaments, all the imagery is abstract, maybe people, churchmen began to say, well, could it be because we have all these pictures in our churches, we have pictures of God the Father and the Virgin Mary and the saints and the figures from the Old Testament. Our churches are covered in these human figures, and when we pray, these figures are there. And they said, well, maybe this breaks a very fundamental rule laid down in the Old Testament by the God of the Jews to Moses, thou shalt not worship graven images.
Right,
So,
and I want to bring you up this because we made an episode about Byzantine art with Robin Cormack a while ago, and I mentioned to him as well when in Eastern Orthodoxy they do kind of worship, more or less worship images, right, of saints, them saints, and it's kind of they kiss the images, and to me it's kind of, in a way, sense a form of paganism, wouldn't you agree? And that's what they discussed during the iconoclasm era as well. Would you agree that it's kind of a form of paganism?
Well, I'm interested. You mentioned Robert Cormack, who is a very fine scholar, and I've learned a great deal from him myself. One of the things I have learned from he's got a marvelous book called Writing in Gold, which goes through all of this, but which I hadn't realized before that a lot of the present day Orthodox practice actually isn't original early Christian practice at all. It actually arose out of the iconoclast controversy because it was at the time when the Byzantines finally reversed iconoclasm and they said, the final decision was actually it's perfectly all right to have images in our churches. And the justification was they said, we always did. But Robin and some other scholars, have actually demonstrated that there were far more images and far more attention was paid to them after iconoclasm than there ever was before. So that actually this was something quite new. In a way, going back to what I was saying earlier, iconoclasm began as a reaction to Islam. They've got no images it looks as though God favoureth them. So perhaps we're sinning by having images. So let's get rid of the images. So the images go, and then, well, you still don't win all the victories. And there are all kinds of reasons, you know, based on tradition and belief and so on, why actually, you know, what's wrong with images after all?
Right.
So they bring them back. And the final conclusion after almost 100 years or more than 100 years was not only will we bring the images back, but actually we will, they clarified it in theological terms. We do not worship these images. Mm. They're not idols that we worship, which would be against Old Testament teaching. But we venerate them,
right?
Which is a very subtle point, because it's more or less the same thing. You know, you can kiss them, you can pray in their presence, but you're not actually worshiping the image as though it was the God. It was God Himself or the saint who's represented. Mm. You venerate the images, mm. and therefore, icons, the paintings, and portable images became absolutely central in the Orthodox. In the Orthodox tradition. And I think it's still, in a way, it's a response to Islam. Instead of saying, well, actually, you know, we'll follow Islam, they're saying, actually, we'll be as different from Islam as we possibly can. They've got no images. We'll cover our churches with images everywhere. And as Christians, we believe that this is pleasing to God. And that's really remained the Orthodox position ever since.
Mm. And of course, we have to move on as well. And next brings us to the infamous Crusades, of course, which is an episode in itself. So let's talk briefly about the three or four Crusades that happens in Constantinople and the reason why.
The reason why? Well, reasons for the Crusades. I mean, it's a fascinating development, and it's got something to do with the rise in Western Europe of the central role of the Pope as the figure, as a regulating the practice and the belief of Christians throughout the whole of Western Europe. It's also got to do with the fact that Western Europeans go on pilgrimages to the Holy Lands, and the immediate catalyst or the immediate cause of the Crusades, I think most people would probably agree, is that it's the dissolution of the Abbasid Caliphate in Baghdad, and the arrival of the Seljuk Turks. This is a group of Turks, so it's not the direct origin of today's Turks of Turkey, but these are Turkic speaking people who rapidly took over both the holy places and a large part of Anatolia. So the Emperor Alexius I in Constantinople was fighting once again on his eastern front in today's Turkey to hold back the Seljuk Turks.
And now before the Alexius, yes, of course, you do have the famous Battle of Manzikert, which is a big loss to the Byzantines.
That's right. That's the first significant arrival of the Seljuk Turks. The year is 1071, and the Byzantine armies face a devastating loss, and even the emperor was taken prisoner by the sultan of the Turks, and that meant that a large part of eastern central Anatolia was lost to the Byzantines. 10 years later, in 1081, the emperor Alexius I came to the throne. And he was the military man, he's a former army commander, who really took charge of the fight back against the Seljuks in Anatolia. Mm. And he lit upon the idea of calling for military support from Western Europe in order to push back the Seljuk Turks. if you're the emperor in Constantinople, you know, where do you send your emissaries? Who's the person? Who do you talk to in Western Europe at the time? The answer is the Pope, because there's no real, you know, there's no emperor in the West, or there is, but he doesn't count in quite the same way. You go to the Pope. And so Alexius appealed to Pope Urban II, and the Pope connected this appeal from Constantinople with his own concerns about the difficulties that Western pilgrims were having in making pilgrimages to Jerusalem, And he hit upon this idea of preaching a military, a spontaneous military expedition to, as he put it, liberate, as he had conceived it, to liberate the Holy Land. You then have two parallel agendas which only converge so far. They're basically in parallel and they don't really meet. Alexius wants military support in winning back Anatolia. Urban, the Pope, doesn't particularly care about Anatolia, but he does have this idea of inspiring his Christian flock in the West by winning back the Holy Land. And so an expedition sets off. They have to travel via Constantinople. They cause enormous problems for the Byzantine emperor, who I think deeply regrets ever having asked them in. But against all expectation, this first crusade, as it became known, was successful, so that in 1099, Jerusalem was conquered by the crusaders, and they proceeded to set up a series of small states on the eastern Mediterranean coast of what we now call the Middle East.
Now, it's worth mentioning as well that Jerusalem wasn't part of been that important, considering, and we talked about this in our episode about Alexius Comnenus with Anthony Candelis, where he said, we talked about that Jerusalem was lost almost 80, 100 years before the Crusade. So it can't have been that, of course, it was significant at the time. That's what the Crusade was all about. But it's surprising that they didn't care about this until almost 80 years after its conquest that they lost Jerusalem.
Well, I mean, the Byzantines didn't particularly care about Jerusalem. They had been reconciled for some time to the fact that they were not going to get those lands back. Alexius was fighting a defensive war to defend what was really the heartland of the Greek-speaking Byzantine empire in Anatolia. So, I mean, in a way, you've got two major power brokers, each trying to harness the other to his own ends. The Byzantine emperor, it wants military support against the military power of the Seljuk Turks. Urban, the Pope, is looking to harness Byzantine support in his bid to reconquer the Holy Land, and storing up trouble for later. The Pope clearly also has an agenda of trying to extend the influence or the role of the papacy to include the Eastern Orthodox part of Christianity as well. There's always this idea of reunifying the Christian Church, the Catholic and the Orthodox, or Western and Eastern. And so it begins as a potential convergence. The East and West could have or set out to fight together for compatible goals. But in the end, their goals became incompatible. And by the time of we're talking about the First Crusade, but 100 years after that, by the time of the Fourth Crusade, it turns out actually to be the Western Crusaders fighting against the Eastern Christian.
So what of course, I mean, we can't go through all the crusades, I'm afraid, but we have the Second Crusade, of course, and then the Third Crusade with King Arthur and Saladin again, and then
Richard the Lionheart.
Richard the Lionheart, my bad. And then we do have the infamous Fourth Crusade, which, why did they turn against Constantinople when they was that the intention from the start that they were going to go to Constantinople and take over the city itself, or
no? It's a sordid story about money. A large part of that is played by the Venetians, who were much more interested in trading than in crusading, but they were providing the ships that were going to take the crusaders to the Holy Land, and the crusaders wanted paying. The Venetians wanted paying,
right,
and the Crusaders didn't have enough money, so they had to raise the money along the way. And at this time, Constantinople, the empire, simply, fatally played into the Crusaders' hands. During the 15 years before the Fourth Crusader reached Constantinople, the empire spectacularly imploded. Emperors came and went, they deposed one another, regional generals tried to set up on their own account and break away from the centre. The whole Byzantine system that had lasted for hundreds of years began just to fall apart, and nobody really understands why. The last of the three great emperors of the Comnenian dynasty, Manuel I, died in 1180, and somehow everything just fell apart after that. So one different they were constantly deposing one another. One candidate for the throne went to the Crusaders and said, "Well, I'll give you the money you need for your crusade if you'll give me back my throne." So that was the perfect pretext for the Venetians and the Crusaders together to divert from the Holy Land, pitch camp opposite Constantinople, and the plan was always, well, we'll put this guy back on his throne. He gets his throne. We get our money. We'll wash our hands of this. We'll get off to Egypt and fight the rest of our crusade. And this inexperienced young lad, you know, he got his throne back, and nobody wanted him, for one thing. And then he double-crossed the crusaders. He said, "Well, actually, you know, now that I've got my throne back, you know, go away. I don't want to pay you." He, as far as we can tell, he could have. The money was there. But this really, really annoyed the Venetians and the Crusaders. And so, there are different historians take different views of this, but the way I see it, it was actually very much at the last minute. Their patience had been exhausted. They'd been double-crossed. They'd been diverted from their goal. They were, you know, within... you know, it's literally striking distance, just a few, you know, just across the water from the richest city in the world. And they just couldn't resist it. They thought, well, okay, we'll just go and we'll take what's our due. And they did. And it was the first time that the massive Theodosian walls that we talked about earlier, which at that time were 800 years old, it was the first time they were breached by an enemy. But the Venetians rowed their ships up against the walls, and they put siege engines on the decks of the ships. Soldiers climbed up on the top of the siege engines, they jumped across onto the walls. It's spectacular, you know, feat of engineering and daring. And of course, once they got in there, they trashed the place. And having done it, they were a little bit ashamed of themselves too, because it was a Christian city they'd trashed.
Right.
The crusade collapsed. Everybody went home with the spoils they'd taken. And the Pope, who'd instigated the crusade in the first place, was a little bit annoyed with them. But it was a fait accompli. And that basically destroyed the power of the Greek-speaking Christian Empire of Constantinople forever.
And of course, this is the start of the end of the empire, as many historians consider this the beginning of the fall of the great Byzantine Empire. But there's one formidable foe. We mentioned the Seljuk Turks, and they would eventually fall as well. But there is one formidable foe that started to rise to power. That is, the Ottomans, which will be a significant cross to the end later in of the Byzantine Empire.
They certainly were. I mean, again, there were different, you know, there were waves of different power groups, warriors, elites that entered Anatolia at different times. And each of them set up, you know, really quite small kingdoms to begin with. I mean, one of the ironies of history was that by the 13th century, not long after the fall of Constantinople to the Western Crusaders, the Seljuk Empire had itself collapsed. If the Byzantine Empire had remained intact, it would have had every opportunity to reconquer a lot of, you know, of its heartland of Anatolia. But in fact, weakened as it was, I mean, it was something of a miracle it survived at all, but greatly reduced with having lost lands and revenues, it was in no position to do that. So for a couple of hundred years, there was a fair degree of anarchy in what is now Turkey. The Seljuks were replaced by various groups of Turkic-speaking Muslims, of whom the most powerful turned out to be the sons of Osman. It's from him that we get the name Osmanli or Ottoman.
The Ottoman Empire was not formed by a guy called Otto.
It was not formed by a guy called Otto. No, he was called Osman. I'm not quite sure how it came to be Otto. He could be called Ottoman, but Ottoman or Othman with a TH was how it was called in Europe at the time. But yes, it was the dynasty created by Osman in one very small city-state on the Sea of Marmara. This was the one that actually grew to power to overcome the other small small sultanates in the region, and in the year 1352, the first Turkish Ottoman mercenaries were shipped across the straits into Europe to fight as mercenaries for the Byzantine Emperor. And after they'd done that, they refused to go home. And that's actually the beginning. 1354 is the first Ottoman-Turkish settlement at Gallipoli in Europe. And from that time on, Ottoman power began to expand into Europe at the expense of what was left of the Byzantine Empire, of course, as also of the Christian kingdoms of Bulgaria, Serbia, and Hungary.
So let's talk about the fall, because there are a few attempts, and most of them failed, though some could have been successful. I believe Murad II could have been successful. Was that Murad II who was the father of Mehmed, if I'm correct?
Murad II?
Yes. So he did try to besiege Constantinople as well, but he failed because he had some other issues to attend. But if that had not happened, he could have succeeded in taking Constantinople.
It could have happened much earlier. I mean, there was another siege at the end of the 1390s, from 1396 to about 1400, 1401, and the Sultan Bayezid probably would have taken Constantinople, or could well had he not been attacked from the other side by the Mongols. Mm. So that gave Constantinople a breathing space.
Mm. But of course,
it was the very young Mehmed II who actually became the conqueror, Fatih, as he's called in Turkish, ever since. When he began prepared for the siege in 1452, brought up his enormous cannon in the early spring of 1453. And finally, it was the relatively new invention of gunpowder and cannon that were able to breach the walls that had been built on the for the Emperor Theodosius almost exactly 1,000 years before.
Hmm. And let's talk about Greece, because now it had switched from Byzantine, of course, to Greece, which is why you talked a lot about them in your book here. But let's talk about Greece, because they do conquer the Greece peninsula as well. So let's talk, and again, I'll keep referring to older episodes, but we did a two-part series as well on the Ottomans, and the host there, our guest there, talked about that the Greeks, they are not very favorable to the Ottomans as their old enemy, and kind of still are to us, Turkey. But they talked about how they were killing everyone, but no, that cannot be the case, he argues, because if the Ottomans did kill every Greek, there wouldn't be any left. But let's talk about Greece under Ottoman rule.
Yeah, well, I mean, in a way, Greece, I mean, what we now call, you know, what we now mean by Greece is, you know, it's only one part of the what was then the Ottoman Empire. Mm. In Europe, it's also only one part of the, you know, the wider Greek-speaking world, and in a way, my book is focused not just on the geographical space that we call Greece, but on the population, the people who spoke Greek, who were at that time much more widely dispersed. So the almost all Greeks after 1453, Greek speakers wherever they live, are subjects of the Ottoman Empire. But the Ottomans, it's a Muslim empire, it's a theocratic empire. Muslims have privileges, and the non-Muslim populations are subjected to various forms of taxation. There are limitations on what they can do, how they dress, how they can behave. But there was no systematic attempt either to convert them to Islam or to, you know, to expel, or still less to exterminate them. And I mean, I make the comparison, the contrast in my book between what happened in the 15th century when the Ottomans conquered the European Balkans, the Christian Balkans, and what happened at the other end of Europe when the Spanish Reconquista, the reconquest from Muslim Spain, you know, completed the Christianization of Spain and Portugal. Because in the West, you have the Inquisition, you have the formal expulsion of all Jews from Aragon and Castile, from modern Spain in 1492. You have the forcible conversion, expulsion, and often systematic torture of Muslims by the Inquisition, with the result that, you know, today there are, well, today, I mean, 100 years ago, there were no Muslims and no Jews in Spain. The contrast in the Ottoman Empire, you know, couldn't have been greater.
Yeah.
There was nothing, I mean, you know, the Greek speakers, they were Christians, they were a subject people, they were in a subordinate position, but they were also, within that, they were, you know, well, it could have been very much worse for them, is what I'm saying. It's not to say that the Ottomans were necessarily especially tolerant in a modern sense. There was nothing particularly benign about this,
right?
But from the, you know, from the point of view of the Ottoman Empire, they really, I mean, the, in a way, you could say that the Christian population was more used to them paying taxes than dead.
And then you mentioned the Jews in Castile and in Spain, and when they were expelled from Spain, where did they go?
They went to the Ottoman Empire, where invariably they were much better tolerated, they were treated much more. Again, they were a subject people, a second class people, but they were, I think, never systematically persecuted in the Ottoman Empire. They had difficulties in modern Turkey at various times, but again, one of history's little ironies, one of the largest Jewish communities ended up in the city of Thessaloniki, Salonika,
right?
Which in the 20th century actually was more a Jewish city than anything else. The Jews were actually the largest, section of that population, of that multicultural city.
I mean, a lot of people love to hate on the Ottomans, especially for the Armenian genocide, which of course is a tragedy and one of the worst things the Ottomans have done. But the British Empire done far worse than the Ottomans. But they, compared to living in the time, the Ottomans weren't as bad as people make them out to be. From my point of view, they aren't any worse than any other empires at the time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get into comparative atrocities.
Right.
I'm just saying they aren't as bad as people make them out to be. Yeah. No. Sure. No. There are some appalling stories of Ottoman cruelty, and certainly when when there were rebellions, or when the Greeks finally revolted in the 1820s,
right.
There were, you know, it is the systematic reprisals against those who rose up against the Ottoman Empire. Well, you know, they were truly horrific. On the other hand, you know, it was a no holds barred contest. It was kill or be killed, and from the Ottoman point of view, these were subject peoples who were rebelling, and basically they forfeited such rights as they had by the act of rebellion. But as I say, I mean, I think that contrast between the Inquisition and the expulsion in Spain, and the Muslim and the Ottoman it's not even assimilation, but co-option of the Christian of the Christian subjects is a very striking one.
So let's talk about the Greek rebellion and their attempt for independence, because it's quite a long struggle, and they do get a lot of support from the West, but also the Ottomans do get support from the recently established Mehmed Ali. So let's talk about for a while the struggle for final independence of Greece.
Well, this begins in 1821, and it's in the context of, what's often called the Age of Revolution, because first of all in the Americas and then in France, peoples have been rising up against their rulers, particularly imperial rulers. It's also the time of the Enlightenment, when values and ideas that go back to classical Greece and Rome are being very actively discussed. Again, people are rediscovering the principles of political self-determination, of democracy. And many Greeks, because the Greeks are very active in trade, they're moving between the Ottoman Empire and Western and Northern Europe and indeed Russia. They're becoming aware of these ideas. So that the idea of the liberal idea of emancipation, fighting for self-determination, actually creating a self-governing state for the Greeks, this really gathers momentum, and it suddenly explodes in 1821, rather unexpectedly the edge of Europe, and it's a time of some considerable instability in the Ottoman Empire as well. And actually, the Ottoman Empire regroups after this loss and becomes stronger again later in the 19th century. But during the 1820s, it was weak, and the Greeks took advantage of that. And the European powers, particularly the powers that had navies, had armed force in the Mediterranean, which is Britain, France, and Russia at that time, these powers all took a great interest in what was happening, because they were afraid that if Ottoman power weakened, or if the Ottomans lost control of the southeast corner of Europe, what would happen then? It's called in history the Eastern Question, what happens after the Ottomans. So there was a kind of, there was self-interest by governments, but there was also a passionate, spontaneous interest among, people throughout Europe and even as far away as America. Here was an oppressed people fighting for, ideas and values that were very deeply held and supported, certainly by progressive people in those days. Didn't they deserve support? And that meant, and as a result, volunteers went to go and fight with the Greeks. It was something unheard of. Nobody ever took up arms voluntarily to fight. You're not fighting for your own home, your own fatherland. You're fighting for somebody else's, and you're not doing it as a mercenary for pay either. You're doing it because you believe in it. And, the most famous of all these volunteers, of course, is Lord Byron, who died in Greece, active on behalf of the Greek War of Independence. But there were about 1,000 of these people who, actually fought. Many of them died. And they really, this had an enormous effect on public opinion, which in turn was articulated in the press. Come 1827, the three powers felt that they had to intervene, and they sent a joint naval force into the Eastern Mediterranean with rather strange orders to enforce peace, impose peace by force.
Right.
How'd you do that? Well, it's a famous story. The Ottomans were fighting back with the help of a fleet which came from Egypt. You mentioned Mehmed Ali, who was the Sultan's vassal in Egypt. He sent his son Ibrahim in charge of a naval force, which basically reconquered the greater part of Greece. Greece was close to being extinguished by the summer of 1827. But the squadron turns up, the three allied fleets, and the draw up outside the Bay of Navarino in southwest Greece, where the Ottoman Navy and the Egyptian Navy are drawn up for the winter. And they sail into the bay, and nobody quite knows what happened after that, because their orders are to keep the peace. But how do you keep the peace by force? The Ottomans said they weren't going to be hemmed in the bay. They tried to sail out. Shots were fired. It turned into a huge naval battle, and the Ottoman and Egyptian fleets were all but destroyed. That meant the great powers had willy-nilly intervened in a contest which they somehow needed to see through. And the upshot of that was that a few years later, Greece was recognized by the great powers, and the Sultan in Constantinople was obliged, really, to sign on the dotted line to accept that Greece would become legally a fully sovereign, independent country.
And this is the first time they really were a country, a united country, because as we mentioned in the last episode, they were more than city-states back in ancient Greece, and in Byzantines, they were ruled from Constantinople. But why did they choose to have a monarchy, and what was the reason for this, having a monarchy in Greece?
I mean, to be fair, the Greeks didn't choose a monarchy. That was basically one of the conditions for the support that after the Battle of Navarino, they had got and weren't prepared to risk. The initiators of the revolution drew up actually not one but three provisional constitutions, which were really quite advanced for their time. They were based on the Constitution of the United States of America and on several successive revolutionary constitutions that had been drawn up in France, but of course had then disappeared from France after the defeat of Napoleon. So they were quite advanced. They were Republican. But the great powers who were supporting Greece after Navarino said, no, you can be a nation state, you could be a new state in Europe, but every European state has to have a monarch, so you'll have one too. Yeah. The Greeks basically said, okay, we'll settle for that. And actually, the Greeks themselves, they didn't particularly want one of their own to be king, because there were so many different sort of power struggles, there were so many different angles to the people who'd fought for their freedom. They actually preferred the king to be an outsider. So it was left to the great powers to choose the king, which they duly did. And their first choice was the man who actually became the king of Belgium, Leopold Saxe-Coburg, and their second choice was Prince Otto of Bavaria, who became the first king of Greece as Otto when he arrived in Greece in 1833 and that really marks the end of the Greek Revolution or Greek War of Independence.
Now, unfortunately, we don't have much time, so we have to kind of rush a little bit as well, but we have to talk about the Balkan Wars, of course. So how What was Greece, Rome? Because they do ally with, they go against the Ottoman Empire. So, but how great is Greece's military force at this time?
Well, in the 19th century, Greece is it's a very new country, it's a very small country on the edge of Europe. And it's dwarfed by the Ottoman Empire, which basically surrounds it on three sides for quite a lot of, right throughout the 19th century. So it's always really dependent, both economically and militarily, on the support of the great powers who helped the Greeks gain their independence in the first place. But right throughout the 19th century, a kind of article of faith for almost everybody who lives in independent Greece is to extend the boundaries of this very small state so as to bring in more of the Greek speakers, Orthodox Christians, who still live under the Ottoman Empire. And this meant really expanding to the south and the north and the east. The great opportunity to do that came in 1912, at a time when there was war between the Ottoman Empire and a new power in Europe, which was Italy. There was internal division within the Ottoman Empire, and a rare alliance between Greece and its northern Balkan neighbours, the Christian states of Bulgaria, Serbia, and Montenegro, the last even smaller than Greece, they formed an alliance in 1912, and they all attacked the Ottoman Empire in the Balkans. And within a very few months, they had basically driven the Ottoman state out of Europe. There was only just a small area around Constantinople itself remained part of the Ottoman Empire. But it was a very precarious alliance. And a few months later, in the summer of 1913, the alliance actually broke up into a second Balkan war. Bulgaria, which had actually made the most gains of all the allies, was then attacked by the three other allies. And the upshot of that was to establish more or less the frontiers that we still have in the Balkans. They weren't absolutely as they are, final as they are today, but they were very close. Which left the Ottoman Empire and latterly Turkey with only a very small slice of Europe as far as Adrianople, and the modern states of Bulgaria and what was for a long time Yugoslavia, and then Albania emerged a little bit later. That frontier was established in 1923. But it was a messy business. It was a violent business. It caused huge destabilization as about a million Muslims from Europe were displaced into Anatolia. And that in turn created enormous pressure on the Christian Orthodox Greek-speaking communities, which were still very large in different parts of Anatolia, particularly in the West. And that leads on to the aftermath of the consequence of the Balkan Wars, but that really that's the story of the Balkan Wars as far as 1913.
Now, you mentioned Adrianople or Edirne today, but the Greeks do capture Edirne eventually, but they are reconquered by Mustafa Kemal after World War One, of course. But they do hold it for a brief moment.
They do. After the First World War, as the treaties were being negotiated, Greece was awarded the eastern part of Thrace, not including Edirne, but not as far as Constantinople, and also quite a large enclave of western Turkey surrounding the city of Izmir called Smyrna in Greece. And Greek troops actually landed in Smyrna, and they occupied part of western Anatolia between 1919 and 1922. It's called in Greek the Asia Minor Campaign, but in Turkey it's remembered as the Turkish War of Independence, because this war between Greece and Turkey at the end of the First World War it brought about the final abolition of the Ottoman Empire and the creation of the modern Republic of Turkey as it exists today, which was established by the military commander, who ironically came from the city of Thessaloniki in today's Greece, Mustafa Kemal, later known as Atatürk, the father of the Turks.
It's interesting to me because, of course, they did fight each other after World War One, and the Greece did have a ship inside Constantinople, so they were fairly close. And even when they fought, had it not been for Mustafa Kemal, the Greeks could have taken, I think, Constantinople as well, and then dream of recreating the Byzantine Empire could have come true, I think, if it had not been for Atatürk or Mustafa Kemal, if you will.
Yes, I mean, I should have said something about that great dream, as it was always called. It was in the 19th century and right up until 1922 when it finally came crashing down in ruins. But for many Greeks, it literally was a dream, and the idea of reconquering Constantinople, that the capital of the Greek-speaking Byzantine Christian Empire might actually one day become the capital of a modern revived Greece. And that that dream was called, it's still called in Greek, the great idea, Megali Idea in Greek. And I mean, people still talk about it. It's nobody believes it, obviously, as something that is attainable now. It came to an end very abruptly with that defeat by Mustafa Kemal in 1922. But you're right. The Greek battleship Averrof was part of the Allied fleet that went to the Straits of the Bosphorus and supported the occupation of Constantinople, the Allied occupation of Constantinople, from 1918 until 1922. But, I mean, the treaty wasn't going to give Constantinople to the Greeks, and I don't think there's any quite imaginable scenario that that could quite have happened. But who knows? You know, fascinating things. I would say, you know, nothing's in history, nothing's inevitable until it happens.
And, of course, we're going to round it up soon, but just talk really quickly about World War II, because they do get invaded by the Italians, which they fail, or because the Italian army was, under Mussolini, was quite badly, and they were humiliated, more or less, and Germany had to intervene. So let's quickly talk about Germany, sorry, Greece under World War II, before moving on to oil and...
Soon. Well, thank you. Yes, I mean you've told that part of the story very, very, very clearly. Yes, I mean after Hitler came to the rescue of his ally Mussolini in 1940, Greece and indeed the whole of the Balkans were quickly put under occupation, and Greece, the state of Greece, was actually divided three ways: between Nazi Germany, Fascist Italy, and Hitler's Balkan ally, Bulgaria. Mm. And there'd always been bad blood between Greece and Bulgaria. So Greece was basically occupied by its enemies. It was a brutal occupation. It lasted for 3.5 years until the end of 1944. And during that time, a very active resistance was formed, particularly in the mountains of mainland Greece. And that was actually quite effective in liberating quite large parts of mountainous Greece. But this also created enormous political problems, because the political initiative behind this, I mean, people were just fighting to reclaim their land, their space, but the political leadership was affiliated to the Communist Party. And this was a time, of course, when there was a complete ideological barrier between the capitalist West and communist Russia, the USSR, ruled by Stalin, who was of course an ally in the Second World War. But as soon as the World War ended, the divisions between communism and the capitalist West came to the fore, and the Greeks found themselves absolutely on the front line of that division that would in time become known as the Cold War.
How close did the Greeks how close were they to becoming a communist protection, if you will, for lack of better words? How close were they into becoming a communist state?
It's very hard to tell, and it's deeply complicated because, I mean, even today the story, you know, the Greeks fought a civil war off and on for 6 years, from 1943, even while the occupation was going on, until 1949, 5 years after it had ended, and it's still seen very much in ideological terms, but it's also, I think, it needs to be seen in geopolitical terms, indeed in nationalist terms. I think it played an enormous part in all of this, that when Churchill and Stalin agreed, or unofficially agreed, to divide up those zones of influence in Europe, Stalin was more interested in the mainland, or the Balkans, and Churchill was much more interested in areas close to the sea. So in a way, the Soviet Union and the British Empire, they weren't directly in competition. And this seems to have been why Stalin was quite relaxed about the British having a predominant influence in Greece, whereas Stalin was determined to conquer, and did conquer pretty crudely, all of the rest of Eastern Europe. Whether he could have, I mean, in terms of ideology, in terms of support he could have gained in Greece, very possibly he could have. But I think the geopolitical calculation was that Greece has always been a maritime country. It depends, it lives by the sea. And it was probably, from Stalin's point of view, it probably wasn't defensible or worth trying to defend. And I suspect that's the bottom line reason why actually Greece, kind of defying geography, stayed with part of the West throughout the Cold War, because it's part of the West through the Mediterranean and through the importance of maritime power. The British, of course, pulled out in 1947, handed over to the Americans. But of course, the American Sixth Fleet has been based in Greece really ever since.
Of course, and of course, we're going to run it up pretty soon. But of course, in 1974, the monarchy is abolished, and they soon find oil, which launched them into a really brief, more golden age shortly. So let's talk about the finding oil and the short, as I call it, golden age for Greece.
Well, I mean, you're right. I mean, that's a good way to frame it, because 1973 is the year of the Yom Kippur War and what I think we now call the first oil crisis.
Mm.
There was suddenly a serious, really serious shortage of oil throughout the West, which far more even than today depended on it. There was talk of rationing throughout the West, and it caused havoc of various sorts. Two months after the end of the Yom Kippur War, an oil prospecting company found oil off the Greek island of Thassos. And, nobody could quite believe it, because suddenly the hunt was on. Everybody was desperate to find more oil, and they found some in Greece. It was under the sea. Now, that oil field has never actually yielded very much. But it was the beginning of serious exploration for oil and gas under the Eastern Mediterranean.
Right.
And suddenly, after the return of the end of dictatorship in Greece in 1974, the return to civilian rule, democracy, it was also the time of new tension between Greece and Turkey. They fought, they came close to fighting over the island of Cyprus, which was divided between a Greek and a Turkish zone in the same year. But at the same time, fatefully, Greece and Turkey are competing to find sources of oil that they can each exploit. And suddenly, from the Turkish point of view, it matters that Ataturk, in determining the basis for the Turkish nation that he created, thought nothing of the sea. He didn't care particularly about the seabed.
Right.
So the the Turkish modern Turkey, he never expressed any interest in Cyprus. He accepted that the Aegean, all of it, the Aegean island, except for two very small strategically placed islands, would be part of Greece. But that meant that the continental shelf under the Aegean was contested, because where it's international waters, the Turks wanted to prospect for oil, and suddenly there was big money involved. And more recently still, that spilled out into the Eastern Mediterranean. There's drilling, there's saber rattling around in the coastal waters and beyond the coastal waters of both Cyprus and Crete. Ever since, it's been a source of political tension between Greece and Turkey. And even in the days when now everybody's talking of trying to wean ourselves off oil and gas and find non-carbon substitutes for these, Greece and Turkey are locked in intense negotiations and various threats are being issued from the Turkish side, indeed, about rights of exploration towards these precious mineral resources under the sea.
Yeah, because As you know, I had the historian on about the Ottoman Navy a while ago, and she said that when she was visiting Turkey and Greece, first, instead of going to one island, but she could have easily just that kind of taken the ship there. I don't remember which island it was, but she's first had to take a ship to the one island, go through some security there, I think, and then she had to go to another island. So it's really complicated, even for tourists, and where both could have benefited from, you know, working with each other. They instead complicate things, even for tourists and regular people who want to visit both Turkey and Greece. So even with this tension, it's really complicated. So many things for the government, but for people in general.
No, it's revived age old rivalries, tensions, competition, between, you know, sort of Christian Greece, Muslim Turkey. Actually, there were times in the 20th century, even in the 19th century, when Greece and Turkey as states, or Greece and the Ottoman Empire, actually had perfectly good working and commercial relationships. But since 1974, they've been a bit on and off, but they've been more off than on. And at the moment, there's further polarization, because in addition to the competition in those respects, the Turkish government under President Erdogan is seemingly becoming much more authoritarian in its style, and more militaristic in its certainly in its rhetoric, with the result that it's strangely, it's not even reported in the national press in Britain, but since last summer, Turkish government spokesmen have actually been issuing explicit threats against Greece. There was talk of actually rockets falling on Athens if the Greek government were not to concede to various Turkish demands. So, unfortunately, this tension is really ratcheting up to a higher pitch than ever today.
Thank you, Amphir. Our time has run out. I know you just places to go and places to things to do. So, of course, again, do you have anything you want to promote? And where can people find your book, The Greeks, A Global History? And any links you wanted to put in the description below before you go?
I'm sorry?
Any links you want me to put in the description below, and anything else you have to wish to promote?
Well, I'm not on social media, so I can't really, I don't think I can contribute anything here.
Okay, thank you very much for coming on to do this two-part mini-series on The Greeks, A Global History. This has been About That Age 12. We are available on Twitter, Spotify, Instagram, under About That Age 12. You can find us on Spotify, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, wherever you can find that podcast these days. If you are on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, please consider writing a little review. Also, make sure to check out some other episodes that we have. I'm sure you're going to find something that you like. My name is Alan. This has been About That Age 12. Please like, share, and subscribe. And I'll see you next time. Take care.
And thank you for your hospitality. I really enjoyed
it. My pleasure.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.